Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. I do this through cooking classes, articles and essays, workshops and lectures, a cooking DVD, and an award-winning cookbook called The Joy of Vegan Baking, and of course this podcast. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com or JoyofVeganBaking.com. Hi everybody. Welcome to the podcast. It's been so amazing to see you all on the message board. For those who haven't joined yet, I highly encourage you to check it out. It's a really fantastic way to connect with other listeners and meet other vegans and support each other and offer resources and recipes to one another. I'm so sorry it took me so long to do this. It was like a revelation one day, and clearly it was the right thing to do. So you can just visit CompassionateCooks.com, and under podcast, you'll see the link to the podcast message board. Also, I'm so glad I made the decision to fulfill book orders myself. For those who want signed copies of The Joy of Vegan Baking, you can certainly order the cookbook from your local bookstore, and I do encourage you to call them and ask them if they have a copy. That would be a huge help. And you can also order it from other online bookstores, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, etc. But if you want a signed copy, you can order it directly through Compassionate Cooks. And my friend and volunteer extraordinaire, Danielle Puller, lovingly fulfills all the orders for the DVD, the cookbook, the buttons, the cooking class gift certificates, and I really could not do it without her. Well, I could do it without her, but I wouldn't get much else done. So thank you, Danielle, and thank you to all of you who order our tools for eating vegan, and that's why I produced those things. That's why I've created those things. Today's sponsors for the podcast are Steve and Edie Staywine, who said this about why they sponsored the podcast. We are fortunate to have a good network of vegan friends, but unfortunate, as are most people, to have family members, coworkers, and bosses who do not share our enthusiasm for compassion. You have helped us to react intelligently and compassionately in many difficult situations. Many of the letters you read are about a dramatic shift from omni to vegan or vegetarian to vegan. Well, we were vegan before we found your podcast, but it really has helped us to become more vegan. We've gone from mostly a do no harm philosophy to being more active, vocal, and, well, proud of our choices. We use phrases like morally superior position, not morally superior person, all the time. Phrases like speak your truth, human and non-human animals, not vegan yet. The list could go on, and these have become mainstays of our vocabulary. We have also discarded thoughtless phrases that are demeaning to animals. It took time, but most of our biggest attackers have been silenced. If we can dedicate our donation to someone, we would like to honor Albie the goat from Woodstock Animal Sanctuary, who is such an inspiration to us. In fact, we recently named our new puppy from a puppy mill rescue after Albie. Spending time with Albie and all the animals at the sanctuary is such a vegan recharge and truly a gift. A good friend of ours recently became vegan from vegetarian, and the first advice we could think of was to get a good support network. We are proud and so thankful to think of you as part of our support network. Thank you for all you do for the animals. Thank you, Steve and Edie. I'm thrilled to be part of your network too. It's really quite an honor. And I know what you mean about going to the animals for a recharge. Those of you who don't have, well, you might have a farmed animal sanctuary around you. I think there's a website. Just type in Farmed Animal Sanctuary Network. There's some kind of network of farmed animal sanctuaries around the country, perhaps around the world, and there might be one near you, or at least one close enough that you could drive to or maybe revolve a vacation around, because being able to get to these sanctuaries to spend time with these animals is quite indescribable. It's really an amazing connection you make with these remarkable creatures. So I'm so glad Steve and Edie have been able to do so, and with a goat, of course, because goats are fantastic. And I'm very grateful for your support, Steve and Edie. So thank you very much, and I hope you're enjoying the recipes. If you would like to become a monthly sponsor to help us continue this work, you too can help this podcast continue, and you get some fun thank you gifts as well. You can sponsor $5 a month or $10 a month or $15 a month, or you can make a one-time contribution. You can visit CompassionateCooks.com and click on Support Our Podcast for your options. Thank you for any help you can provide. It really means so much to me that this podcast is completely 100% listener supported, and I just think that's so fantastic. This podcast is really for you and by you because of the support you're able to give me. So thank you, everybody. Thank you very much. As regular listeners know, the format for today's episode is such that I read something by someone other than myself, drawing from poetry, literature, nonfiction, etc. Today, I'm going to read a really lovely short story by Susan Glasspell called The Anarchist, His Dog, written in 1912 and originally part of a collection of short stories called Lifted Masks. Susan Glasspell was a best-selling novelist and a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who lived from 1876 to 1948. When I found this short story, I had known only a little about her. I knew she was close with Eugene O'Neill. I had read her play Trifles many years ago, and I knew she was involved in social justice issues and progressive causes, social and feminist and economic progressive causes, and this is reflected in her plays and in her stories. According to Wikipedia, her novels and plays are, quote, committed to developing deep sympathetic characters, to understanding life in its complexity. Though realism was the medium of her fiction, she was also greatly interested in philosophy and religion, and many of her characters make principled stands. That's from Wikipedia. And that's exactly why I chose the story I did today. Today's story is about a little boy who takes a very principled stand to protect his dog. I absolutely fell in love with this little boy, and I'll admit that I had to pause a few times when I first read it because it choked me up quite a bit, and hopefully I'll be able to get through this without having to do that. Glasspell just beautifully captures the innocence of childhood, and the reader quite gets inside the mind of this child who we both root for and sympathize with. So here we go. The Anarchist, His Dog by Susan Glasspell. Stubby had a root, and that was how he happened to get a dog. For the benefit of those who have never carried papers, it should be thrown in that having a root means getting up just when there really is some fun in sleeping, lining up at the leader office, maybe having a scrap with the fellow who says you took his place in the line, getting your papers all damp from the press, and starting for the outskirts of the city. Then you double up the paper in the way that will cause all possible difficulty in undoubling it, and hurl it with what force you have against the front door. It is good to have a root, for you at least earn your salt, so your father can't say that anymore. If he does, you know it isn't so. When you have a root, you whistle. All the fellows whistle. They may not feel like it, but it is the custom, as could be sworn to by many sleepy citizens, and as time goes on, you succeed in acquiring the easy manner of a brigand. Stubby was little, and everything about him seemed sawed off just a second too soon, his nose, his fingers, and most of all, his hair. His head was a faithful replica of a chestnut burr. His hair did not lie down and take things easy. It stood up and out. Gentle ladies couldn't possibly have let their hands sink into it, as we are told they do, for the hands just wouldn't sink. They'd have to float. And alas, gentle ladies didn't particularly want their hands to sink into it. There was not that about Stubby's short person to cause the hands of gentle ladies to move instinctively to his head. Stubby bristled. That is, he appeared to bristle. Inwardly, Stubby yearned, though he would have swung into his very best brigand manner on the spot were you to suggest so offensive a thing. Just to look at Stubby, you'd never in 1,000 years guess what a funny feeling he had sometimes when he got to the top of the hill where his root began and could see a long way down the river and the town curled in on the other side. Sometimes, when the morning sun was shining through a mist, making things awful queer, some of the mist got into Stubby's squinty little eyes. After the mist behaved, he always whistled so rakishly and threw his papers with such abandonment that people turned over in their beds and muttered things about having that little heathen of a paper boy shot. All along the route are dogs. Indeed, routes are distinguished by their dogs. Mean routes are those that have terraces and mean dogs. Good routes, where the houses are close together and the dogs run out and wag their tails. Though Stubby's greater difficulty came through the wagging tails, he carried in a collie neighborhood, and all collies seemed consumed with mighty ambitions to have roots. If you spoke to them, and how could you help speaking to a collie when he came bounding out to you that way? You had an awful time chasing him back, and when he got lost, and it seemed collies spent most of their time getting lost, the woman would put her head out next morning and want to know if you had coaxed her dog away. Some of the fellows had dogs that went with them on their routes. One day, one of them asked Stubby why he didn't have a dog, and he replied in surly fashion that he didn't have one because he didn't want one. If he wanted one, he guessed he'd have one. And there was no one within earshot old enough, or wise enough, or tender enough to know from the meanness of Stubby's tone and by his evil scowl that his heart was just breaking to own a dog. One day a new dog appeared along the route. He was yellow and looked like a cheap edition of a bulldog. He was that kind of dog most accurately described by saying it is hard to describe him, the kind you say is just dog, and everybody knows. He tried to follow Stubby, not in the trusting, bounding manner of the collies, not happily, but hopingly. Stubby, true to the ethics of his profession, chased him back where he had come from. That there might be nothing whatever on his conscience, he even threw a stone after him. Stubby was an expert in throwing things at dogs. He could seem to just miss them and yet never hit them. The next day it happened again, but just as he had a clod poised for throwing, a window went up and a woman called, "For pity's sake, little boy, don't chase him back here." Why, ain't he yours?" called Stubby. "Mercy, no, we can't chase him away." "Whose is he?" demanded Stubby. "Why, he's nobody's. He just hangs around. I wish you'd coax him away." Well, that was a new one. And then, all in a heap, it rushed over Stubby that this dog, who was nobody's dog, could, if he coaxed him away and the woman wanted him coaxed away, be his dog. And because that idea had such a strange effect on him, he sang out in offhand fashion, "Oh, all right, I'll take him away and drown him for you." "Oh, little boy," called the woman, "why, don't drown him." "Oh, all right, I'll shoot him then," called obliging Stubby, whistling for the dog, while all morning long the woman grieved over having sent a helpless little dog away with that perfectly brutal paper boy. Stubby's mother was washing. She looked up from her tubs on the back porch to say, "Wish you'd take that bucket." Then, seeing what was slinking behind her son, straightway assumed the role of destiny with, "Get out of here." Stubby snapped his fingers behind his back as much to say, "Wait a minute." "A woman gave him to me," he said to his mother. "Gave him to you," she scoffed. "I should think she would." Then something happened that had not happened many times in Stubby's short lifetime. He acknowledged his feelings. "I'd like to keep him. I'd like to have a dog." His mother shook her hands, and the flying suds seemed expressing her scorn. "Ha! That ugly good-for-nothing thing!" The dog had edged in between Stubby's feet and crouched there. "He could go with me on my route," said Stubby. "He'd kind of be company for me." And when he had said that, he knew all at once just how lonesome he had been sometimes on his route, how he had wanted something to kind of be company for him. His face twitched as he stooped down to pat the dog. Mrs. Lynch looked at her son, youngest of her five. Not the hardness of her heart, but the hardness of her life had made her unpracticed in moments of tenderness. Something in the way Stubby was patting the dog suggested to her that Stubby was a queer one. He was kind of little to be carrying papers all by himself. Stubby looked up. "He could eat what's thrown away." That was an error in diplomacy. The woman's face hardened. "Mighty little'll be thrown away this winter," she muttered. But just then, Mrs. Johnson appeared on the other side of the fence and began hanging up her clothes, and with that, Mrs. Lynch saw her way to justify herself in indulging her son. Mrs. Johnson and Mrs. Lynch had had words. "You just let him stay around, Stubby," she called, and you would have supposed from her tone it was Stubby who was on the other side of that fence. "Maybe he'll keep the neighbors' chickens out. Them that ain't got chickens of their own don't want to be bothered with the neighbors." That was how it happened that he stayed, and no one but Stubby knew, and possibly Stubby didn't either, how it happened that he was named Hero. It would seem that Hero should be a noble Saint Bernard, or a particularly mean-looking bulldog, not a stocky, shapeless, squint-eyed yellow dog with one ear bitten off and one leg built on an entirely different plan from its fellow legs. Possibly Stubby's own spiritual experiences had suggested to him that you weren't necessarily the way you looked. The chickens were pretty well kept out, though no one ever saw Hero doing any of it. Perhaps Hero had been too long associated with chasing to desire any part of it, even with the roles reversed. If Stubby could help it, no one really saw Stubby doing the chasing either. He became skilled in chasing when he did not appear to be chasing. Then he would get Hero to barking and turn his mother with, "Guess you don't see so many chickens around nowadays." The fellows in the line jeered at Hero at first, but they soon tired of it when Stubby said he didn't want the cur, but his mother made him stay around to keep the chickens out. He was a fine chicken dog, Stubby grudgingly admitted. He couldn't keep him from following, said Stubby, so he just let him come. Sometimes when they were waiting in line, Stubby made ferocious threats at Hero. He was going to break his back and wring his head off and do other heartless things, which for some reason he never started in right then and there to accomplish. It was different when they were alone, and they were alone a good deal. Stubby's route wasn't nearly so long after he had Hero to go with him. When winter came and 5 o'clock was dark and cold for starting out, it was pretty good to have Hero trotting at his heels. And Hero always wanted to go. It was never so rainy nor so cold that that yellow dog seemed to think he would rather stay home by the fire. Then Hero was always waiting for him when he came home from school. Stubby would sing out, "Hello, cur," and the tone was such that Hero did not grasp that he was being insulted. Sometimes, when there was nobody about, Stubby picked Hero up in his arms and squeezed him. Stubby had not had a large experience with squeezing. At those times, Hero would lick Stubby's face and whimper a little love whimper, and such were the workings of Stubby's heart and mind that that made him of quite as much account as if he really had chased the chickens. Stubby, who had seen the way dogs can look at you out of their eyes, was not one to say of a dog, "What good is he?" But it seemed there were such people. There were even people who thought you oughtn't to have a dog to love and to love you if you weren't one of those rich people who could pay $2.50 a year for the luxury. Stubby first heard of those people one night in June. The father of the Lynch family was sitting in the backyard reading the paper when Hero and Stubby came running in from the alley. It was one of those moments when Hero, forgetting the bleakness of his youth, abandoned himself to the joy of living. He was tearing round and round Stubby, barking, when Stubby's father called out, "Here, shut up, you cur, you better lie low, you're going to be shot the 1st of August." Stubby, and as regards the joy of living, Hero had done as much for Stubby as Stubby for Hero, came to a halt. The fun and frolic just died right out of him, and he stood there staring at his father, who had turned the page and was settling himself to a new horror. At last, Stubby spoke. "Why is he going to be shot on the 1st of August?" he asked in a tight little voice. His father looked up. "Why is he going to be shot? You got any $2.50 to pay for him?" He laughed as though that were a joke. Well, it was something of a joke. Stubby got 10 cents a week out of his paper money. The rest he turned in. Then he went back to his paper. There was another long pause before Stubby asked in that tight, queer little voice, "What I'd have to pay $2.50 for? Nobody owns him." His parents stirred scornfully. "Suppose you ever heard of a dog tax, did you? Suppose they don't learn you nothing like that in school?" Yes, Stubby did know that dogs had to have checks, but he hadn't thought anything about that in connection with Hero. He ventured another question. "You have to have them for all dogs, even if you just picked them up on the street and took care of them when nobody else would?" You bet you do, his parent assured him genially. You pay your dog tax, or the policeman comes on the 1st of August and shoots your dog, burying himself in his paper. For a minute, the boy stood there in silence. Then he walked slowly round the house and sat down where his father couldn't see him. Hero followed. It was a way Hero had. The dog sat down beside the boy, and after a couple of minutes, the boy's arm stole furtively around him, and they sat there for a very long time. As nobody but Hero paid much attention to him, nobody save Hero noticed how quiet and queer Stubby was for the next 3 days. Hero must have noticed, for he was quiet and queer too. He followed wherever Stubby would let him, and every time he got a chance, he would nestle up to him and look into his face. That way even cur dogs have of doing when they fear something is wrong. At the end of 3 days, Stubby, his little freckled face set and grim, took his stand in front of his father and came right out with it. I want to keep 1 week's paper money to pay Hero's tax. His father's chair had been tilted back against a tree. Now it came down with a thud. Oh, you do you? I can earn the other 50 cents at little jobs. You can you? Now ain't you smart? The tone brought the blood to Stubby's face. I think I got a right to, he said, his voice low. The man's face, which had been taunting, grew ugly. Look a here, young man, none of your lip. The tears rushed to Stubby's face, but he stumbled on. I guess Hero's got a right to some of my paper money when he goes with me every day on my route. At that, his father stared for a minute and then burst into a loud laugh. Blinded by tears, the boy turned to the house. After she had gone to bed that night, Stubby's mother heard a sound from the alcove at the head of the stairs where her youngest child slept. As the sound kept on, she got out of her bed and went to Stubby's cot. Look here, she said awkwardly, but not unkindly. This won't do. We're poor folks, Freddy. It was only once in a while she called him that. All we can do to live these times, we can't pay no dog tax. As Stubby did not speak, she added, I know you've taken to the dog, but just the same, you ain't to feel hard to your pa. He can't help it, and neither can I. Things is as they is. Nobody can help it. As despite this bit of philosophy, Stubby was still gulping back sobs, she added what she thought a master stroke in consolation. Now you just go right to sleep, and if they come to take this dog away, maybe you can pick up another one in the fall. The sobs suddenly stopped, and Stubby stared at her. And what he said, after a long stare, was, I guess there ain't no use in you and me talking about it. That's right, she said, relieved. Now you go right off to sleep. And she left him, never dreaming why Stubby had seen there was no use talking about it. Nor did he talk about it, but a change came over Stubby's funny little person in the next few days. The change was particularly concerned with his jaw, though there was something different, too, in the light in his eyes as he looked straight ahead, and something different in his voice when he said, Come on, Hero. He got so he could walk into a store and demand, in a hard little voice, Want a boy to do anything for you? And when they said, Got more boys than we know what to do with, sonny, Stubby would say, All right. And stalk sturdily out again. Sometimes they laughed and said, What could you do? And then Stubby would stalk out, but possibly a little less sturdily. Vacation came the next week, and still he had found nothing. His father, however, had been more successful. He found a place where they wanted a boy to work in a yard a couple of hours in the morning. For that, Stubby was to get $1.50 a week, but that was to be turned in for his keep. There were lots of mouths to feed, as Stubby's mother was always calling to her neighbor across the alley. But the yard gave Stubby an idea, and he earned some dimes and 1/4 in the next week. Most folks thought he was too little. One kind lady told him he ought to be playing, not working. But there were people who would let him take a big shears and cut grass around flower beds and things like that. This he had to do afternoons when he was supposed to be off playing. And when he came home, his mother sometimes said, Some folks had it easy, playing around all day. It was now the first week in July, and Stubby had $1.20. It was getting to the point where he would wake in the night and find himself sitting up in bed, hands clenched. He dreamed dreams about how folks would let him live if he had 99 cents, but how he only had 97 and a half, so they were going to shoot him. Then one day, he found Mr. Stewart. He was passing the house after having asked 3 people if they wanted a boy, and they didn't, and seemed so surprised at the idea of their wanting him that Stubby's throat was all tight. And when Mr. Stewart sang out, "Say, boy, want a little job?" it seemed at first that it must be a joke, or a dream, anybody asking him if he wanted one. But the man was beckoning to him, so he pulled himself together and ran up the steps. "Now here's a little package." He took something out of the mailbox. "It doesn't belong here. It's to go to 302 Pleasant Street. You take it for a dime?" Stubby nodded. As he was going down the steps, the man called, "Say, boy, how'd you like a steady job?" For the first minute, it seemed pretty mean, making fun of a fellow that way. "This will be here every day. Suppose you come each day about this time and take it over there, not mentioning it to anybody." Stubby felt weak. "Why, all right," he managed to say. "I'll give you 50 cents a week. That fair?" "Yes, sir," said Stubby, doing some quick calculation. "Then here goes for the first week," and he handed him the other 40 cents. It was funny how fast the world could change. Stubby wanted to run. He hadn't been doing much running of late. He wanted to go home and get Hero to go with him to Pleasant Street, but didn't. No, sir. When you had a job, you had to tend to things. Well, a person could do things if he had to, thought Stubby. No use saying you couldn't. You could if you had to. He was back in tune with life. He whistled. He turned up his collar in the old rakish way. Back home, he jumped over the fence instead of going in the gate. Lately, he had actually been using the gate, and he cried, "Get out of my sight, you cur," in tones which, as Hero understood things, meant anything but getting out of his sight. He was a little boy again. He slept at night as little boys sleep. He played with Hero along the route, taught him some new tricks. His jaw relaxed from its grown-uppishness. It was funny about those Storts. Sometimes he saw Mr. Stewart, but never anybody else. The place seemed shut up. But each day the little package was there, and every day he took it to Pleasant Street and left it at the door there. That place seemed shut up, too. When it was well into the second week, Stubby ventured to say something about the next 50 cents. The man fumbled in his pockets. Something in his face was familiar to experienced Stubby. It suggested a having to have $2.50 by August 1st and only having $1.25 state of mind. "I haven't got the change. Pay you at the end of next week for the whole business? That all right?" Stubby considered. "I've got to have it before the 1st of August," he said. At that, the man laughed. Funny kind of laugh it was, and muttered something, but he told Stubby he would have it before the 1st. It bothered Stubby. He wished the man had given it to him then. He would rather get it each week and keep it himself. A little of the grown-up look stole back. After that, he didn't see Mr. Stewart. And one day, a week or so later, the package was not in the box, and a man who wore the same kind of clothes Stubby's father wore came around the house and asked him what he was doing. Stubby was wary. "Oh, I've got a little job I do for Mr. Stewart." The man laughed. "I had a little job I did for Mr. Stewart, too. You paid in advance?" Stubby pricked up his ears. "'Cause if you ain't, I'd advise you to look out for a little job somewheres else." Then it came out. Mr. Stewart was broke. More than that, he was off his nut. Lots of people were doing little jobs for him. There was no sense in any of them, and now he had suddenly been called out of town. There was a trembly feeling through Stubby's insides, but outwardly he was bristling, just like his hair bristled, as he demanded, "Where am I going to get what's coming to me?" "'Fraid you won't get it, Sonny. We're all in the same boat." He looked Stubby up and down, then added, "Kinda little for that boat." "I got to have it," cried Stubby. "I tell you, I got to." The man shook his head. "That cuts no ice. Hard luck, Sonny. But we've got to take our medicine in this world. 'Tain't no medicine for kids, though," he muttered. Stubby's face just then was too much for him. He put his hand in his pocket and drew out a dime, saying, "There now, you run along and get you a soda and forget your troubles. It ain't always like this. You'll have better luck next time." But Stubby did not get the soda. He put the dime in his pocket and turned toward home. Something was the matter with his legs. They acted funny about carrying him. He tried to whistle, but something was the matter with his lips, too. Counting his dime, he now had $1.80, and it was the 28th day of July. 30 days had September, April, June, and November, he was saying to himself. Then July was one of the long ones. Well, that was a good thing. Been a great deal worse if July was a short one. Again, he tried to whistle, and that time did manage to pipe out a few shrill little notes. When Hero came running up the hill to meet him, he slapped him on the back and cried, "Hello, Hero," in tones fairly swaggering with bravado. That night, he engaged his father in conversation. The phrase is well adapted to the way Stubby went about it. "How's about things like taxes?" Stubby crossed his knees and swung one foot to show his indifference. "If you have almost enough, do they sometimes let you off?" The detachment was a shade less perfect than that last. His father laughed scoffingly. "Well, I guess not. I thought maybe," said Stubby, "if a person had tried awful hard and had most enough..." Something inside him was all shaky, so he didn't go on. His father said that trying didn't have anything to do with it. It was hard for Stubby not to sob out that he thought trying ought to have something to do with it, but he only made a hissing noise between his teeth that took the place of the whistle that wouldn't come. "Kind of seems if a person would have had enough if they hadn't been beat out of it. Maybe if he had done the best he could..." His father snorted derisively and informed him that doing the best you could made no difference to the government. Hard luck stories didn't go when it came to the laws of the land. Thereupon, Stubby took a little walk out to the alley and spent a considerable time in contemplation of the neighbor's chicken yard. When he came back, he walked right up to his father and, standing there, feet planted, shoulders squared, wanted to know, in a desperate little voice, if someone else was to give, say, $1.80 for Hero, could I take the other 70 cents out of my paper money? The man turned upon him roughly. "Aha! That's it, is it? That's why you're getting so smart all of a sudden about government. Look here, just let me tell you something. You're lucky if you get enough to eat this winter. Do you know there's talk of the factory shutting down? Dog tax. Why, you're lucky if you get shoes." Stubby had turned away and was standing with his back to his father, hands in his pockets. "And let me tell you something else, young man. If you got any $1.80, you give it to your mother." As Stubby was turning the corner of the house, he called after him. "How'd you like me to get you an automobile?" He went doggedly from house to house the next afternoon, but nobody had any jobs. When Hero came running out to him that night, he patted him but didn't speak. That evening, as they were sitting in the backyard, Stubby and Hero a little apart from the others, his father was discoursing with his brother about anarchists. They were getting commoner, his father thought. There were a good many of them at the shop. They didn't call themselves that, but that's what they were. "Well, what is an anarchist, anyhow?" Stubby's mother wanted to know. "Why, an anarchist," her lord informed her, "is one that's against the government. He don't believe in the law and order. The real bad anarchist, shoot them that tries to enforce the laws of the land. Guess if you'd read the papers these days, you'd know." Stubby's brain had been going round and round, and these words caught in it as it whirled. The government, the laws of the land. Why, it was the government and the laws of the land that were going to shoot Hero. It was the government, the laws of the land that didn't care how hard you had tried, didn't care whether you had been cheated, didn't care how you felt, didn't care about anything except getting the money. His brain got hotter. Well, he didn't believe in the government either. He was one of those people, those anarchists, that were against the laws of the land. He'd done the very best he could, and now the government was going to take Hero away from him just because he couldn't get the other 70 cents. Stubby's mother didn't hear her son crying that night. That was because Stubby was successful in holding the pillow over his head. The next morning, he looked in one of the papers he was carrying to see what it said about anarchists. Sure enough, someplace off somewhere, the anarchist had shot somebody that was trying to enforce the laws of the land. The laws of the land that didn't care. That afternoon, as Stubby tramped around looking for jobs, he saw a good many boys playing with dogs. None of them seemed to be worrying about whether their dogs had checks. To Stubby's hot little brain and sore little heart came the thought that they didn't love their dogs any more than he loved Hero either. But the government didn't care whether he loved Hero or not. Pooh! What was that to the government? All it cared about was getting the money. He stood for a long time watching a boy giving his dog a bath. The dog was trying to get away, and the boy and another boy were having lots of fun about it. All of a sudden, Stubby turned and ran away, ran down the alley, ran through a number of alleys, just kept on running, blinded by the tears. And that night, in the middle of the night, that something in his head going round and round, getting hotter and hotter, he decided that the only thing for him to do was to shoot the policeman who came to take Hero away on the morning of August 1st. That would be day after tomorrow. All night long, policemen with revolvers stood around his bed. When his mother called him at 4:30, he was shaking so he could scarcely get into his clothes. On his way home from his route, Stubby had to pass a police station. He went on to the other side of the street and stood there looking across. One of the policemen was playing with a dog. Suddenly, he wanted to rush over and throw himself at that policeman's feet, sob out the story, ask him to please, please wait till he could get the other 70 cents. But just then, the policeman got up and went into the station, and Stubby was afraid to go into the police station. That policeman complicated things for Stubby. Before that, it had been quite simple. The policeman would come to enforce the law of the land, but he did not believe in the law of the land, so he would just kill the policeman. But it seemed a policeman wasn't just a person who enforced the laws of the land, he was also a person who played with a dog. After a whole day of walking around thinking about it, his eyes burning, his heart pounding, he decided that the thing to do was to warn the policeman by writing a letter. He did not know whether real anarchists warned them or not, but Stubby couldn't get reconciled to the idea of killing a person without telling him you were going to do it. It seemed that even a policeman should be told, especially a policeman who played with a dog. The following letter was penciled by a shaking hand late that afternoon. It was written upon a barrel in the Lynch woodshed on a piece of wrapping paper, a bristly little head bending over it. To the policeman who comes to take my dog, 'cause I ain't got the 250, 'cause I tried but could only get 180, 'cause a man was off his nut and didn't pay me what I earned. This is to tell you. I am an anarchist, and do not believe in the government or the law of the land, and will shoot you when you come. I wouldn't have been an anarchist if I could have got the money, and I tried to get it, but I couldn't get it, not enough. I don't think the government had ought to take things you like I like Hero, so I am against the government. Thought I would tell you first. Yours truly, F. Lynch. I don't see how I can shoot you, because where would I get the revolver? So I will have to do it with the butcher knife. Folks are sometimes killed that way because my father read it in the paper. If you wanted to take the 180 and leave Hero till I can get the 70, I will not do anything to you and would be very much obliged. 1113 Willow Street. The letter was properly addressed and sealed. Not for nothing had Stubby's teacher given those instructions in the art of letter writing. The stamp he paid for out of the dime the man gave him to get a soda with and forget his troubles. Now, Bill O'Brien was on the desk at the police station, and Miss Murphy of the Herald stood in with Bill. That was how it came about that the next morning a fat policeman, an eager-looking girl, and a young fellow with a Kodak descended into the hollow to 1113 Willow Street. A little boy peeped around the corner of the house, such a wild-looking little boy, hair all standing up and eyes glittering. A yellow dog ran out and barked. The boy darted out and grabbed the dog in his arms, and in that moment the girl called to the man with the black box, "Right now, quick, get him!" They were getting ready to shoot Hero. That box was the way police did it. Boy and dog sank to the ground, but just the same, the boy was shielding the dog. When Stubby had pulled himself together, the policeman was holding Hero. He said that Hero was certainly a fine dog. He had a dog a good deal like him at home. And Miss Murphy, she was choking back sobs herself, knew how he could earn the 70 cents that afternoon. In such ways do a good anarchist and a good story go down under the same blow. Some of those sobs Miss Murphy choked back got into what she wrote about Stubby and his yellow dog. And the next day, citizens with no sense of the dramatic sent money enough to check Hero through life. At first, Stubby's father said he had a good mind to lick him. But something in the quality of Miss Murphy's journalism left a hazy feeling of there being something remarkable about his son. He confided to his good wife that it wouldn't surprise him much if Stubby was someday president. Somebody had to be president, said he, and he had noticed it was generally those who in their youthful days did things that made lively reading in the newspapers. So that's the story. I mean, it's a very cute ending, and it's a very happy ending, and thank goodness it's a happy ending. We needed a happy ending after all that stress and tension that Stubby had to go through. I just think that was just such a sweet story on quite a few different levels. So I hope you enjoyed it, and I will certainly put a link to it up on the message board. And by the way, I want to thank Elizabeth Mateson. And Elizabeth, please forgive me if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, but Elizabeth has been so generously and graciously adding to the message board a section that has the resources from all of the podcast episodes. So you can link to, you know, stores that I recommend or products that I recommend or books that I recommend or stories like this. And thanks to Elizabeth, we're able to have that up on the podcast message board. So check it out. And thank you, Elizabeth. And on behalf of the animals and on behalf of all of the Stubbies out there who are shielding and protecting animals, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.